This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Several Wisconsin labor unions filed a new lawsuit last week challenging Act 10, the 2011 law that ended almost all collective bargaining for most public employees. The law has been unsuccessfully challenged in court multiple times since it was enacted. The latest lawsuit makes a different legal argument and could make its way to a state Supreme Court that now has a 4-3 liberal majority. We're exploring what makes this lawsuit different from previous state court challenges to Act 10 and the dynamics with the current makeup of the state's highest court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this latest Act 10 lawsuit? Do you think the outcome will be different this time? Should be different this time? What questions do you have? Do you think Justice Janet Protasiewicz should recuse herself from the case based on past comments? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. A lot of public employees in Wisconsin are familiar with Act 10. People who are around for the hullabaloo remember it. Can you remind us, though, what the law changed?
Well, Act 10 essentially abolished collective bargaining for public employees, and the biggest target by far was the teachers' union, except as to very, very limited matters involving salary up to a certain point. Depending on who you ask, the reason was to save the state's budgetary resources and make school districts better able to allocate their resources, so they were able to pay some teachers less, for example, if they weren't performing well, and reward teachers who might be more junior but were good teachers, and so to generally increase flexibility. On the other side, people who opposed Act 10 said it was a targeted effort to weaken public sector unions, which had been strongly supportive of Democratic candidates, and of course, a fair number of observers thought it did both.
Now, some public employee unions were exempted in the public safety field, thinking mainly police and firefighting unions. And that, Howard, is, as I understand it, is at the heart of this constitutional challenge in Wisconsin courts. What is this lawsuit arguing?
That's exactly right. So the lawsuit is brought under the Equal Protection Clause of the Wisconsin Constitution. And I should note right off the bat that in 1999, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that the Wisconsin Equal Protection Clause works exactly the same as the federal constitutional Equal Protection Clause. So everything people know about equal protection law applies here as well. And the claim is there was no good reason, no legitimate reason connected to the purpose of the bill for singling out public safety employees to exempt them from the operation of this disqualification from collective bargaining. Now, there's a couple of pieces to that argument. One is the claim that since the purpose of the bill was allegedly to save money and conserve budgetary resources, only motivations having to do with conserving money and conserving budgetary resources could legitimately justify treating one group of employees differently from another. The second part of the argument is that in general, there's no good reason, no legitimate or rational basis for treating these public safety employees differently than we treat, say, teachers. So those are two sides of the same argument, which is that people are being treated differently for no good reason. And that fundamentally is the equal protection claim that's being made here.
Now, the counter argument there has been some of these public safety officers have different pension plans and things like that. They are compensated differently, different retirement benefits based on the nature of their work. So since we've treated them in contract terms differently than other public employees, that gives a precedent to do it with Act 10. Do you see that as being a likely counter argument in the courts?
Well, that by itself, I don't think is a particularly strong argument because, of course, the response is, well, maybe that was unconstitutional as well. That is, you can't really establish the constitutionality of a practice by saying, well, we did it before, because it's equally easy to say that that prior act was also unconstitutional. But here we have to get a little bit into the weeds of this thing. In an equal protection claim, it makes a big difference what kind of people are being treated differently or on what basis. So I'm sure all our listeners remember the recent case about race-based affirmative action in college admissions at the U.S. Supreme Court that got an enormous amount of press. The reason that case was argued the way it was is because when the government wants to treat people differently based on their race, it almost never is able to satisfy the required justification. There's almost never a good enough reason to justify treating people differently on the basis of their race, their religion, their nationality. And that's what's called that. Those kinds of classifications trigger what is called strict scrutiny. And the short version of that is it's sometimes called strict in theory, fatal in fact. Basically, it's extraordinarily difficult to justify treating people differently on those sorts of bases, and the government almost never can do so. That's not what we have here, though. Here, the idea is that people are being treated differently depending on the nature of their employment, and that one group of employees who are in public safety areas are being treated differently from those who are called general employees. That kind of classification only triggers what's called rational basis. It's the lowest level of scrutiny. And again, to put that in practical terms, if the government has any legitimate reason or can come up with any legitimate reason for treating people differently, that's all they have to do. And so here I would think that the government's stronger argument would be something like, look, we recognize that Act 10 was controversial. We recognize that this loss of collective bargaining might cause disruption. We can tolerate that kind of disruption in some areas, but not where public safety employees are involved. And that's our rational basis for keeping them happier. And that would be, as near as I can tell, a perfectly sufficient constitutional justification for the way the law is structured.
Now, there have been a lot of lawsuits related to Act 10. As I understand it, Howard, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this specific equal protection argument hasn't made its way to Wisconsin Supreme Court yet. But there have been federal cases under equal protection. Obviously, Act 10 is still in place, so those fizzled somewhere in the court system. If this argument didn't work in the federal courts, is there a reason to believe it should prevail in state courts?
Well, that's exactly right. Precisely this argument, or a variation, and it was brought to the Seventh Circuit, which is the federal court of appeals, and the Seventh Circuit said, no, the Wisconsin law, Act 10, is perfectly constitutional, essentially for the reasons I just described. There are a couple of reasons why you might think the Wisconsin court might rule differently. First, you might think that the Wisconsin Constitution's Equal Protection Clause works differently than the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause that the Seventh Circuit was talking about. But that's why right at the beginning I made the point that they're not, that the Wisconsin court, at least in the past, has said they work the same. So that's not a good argument unless you can persuade the Wisconsin Supreme Court to change that. The second reason is sort of pure politics. There's now a liberal majority, and so if you think that courts are purely outcome-driven partisans and the judges are partisans seeking policy advantage, then maybe these justices won't like Act 10 and will find a reason to strike it down. Those are, those are the gambles that the people challenging the law are making. And I have to say, I don't think that they will succeed. I find it hard to imagine that the Wisconsin Supreme Court will either abandon the idea that equal protection under the Wisconsin Constitution works the same way as it does under the federal Constitution, or be willing to apply that test. Now, they're not bound by the Seventh Circuit, but I find it hard to believe they'd be willing to apply that test in a way that would have so many repercussions for other potential future lawsuits and do so much to disrupt the way equal protection law is understood in Wisconsin.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus, affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison, looking at the latest legal challenge in a long series of legal challenges to Act 10, the state law restricting almost all collective bargaining for most public employees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Howard, I want to follow up on that. We focused a lot on the legal side of things. The cynical view is what you just described there. We have conservative justices and liberal justices, or in effect, Republican justices and Democratic justices in this cynical view. None of that legal stuff matters in that argument. They're going to vote the way their partisan sympathies lie. Is that too cynical to think that way?
I think it is. Now, I'm the first to say, and I've said so publicly many times, that Wisconsin Supreme Court elections have become hyper-partisan, hyper-politicized affairs and have strayed far away from Wisconsin, what was once the Wisconsin tradition of a nonpartisan judiciary. But this is going further. Let me be neither naive nor purely cynical. Even if one thinks it's true that the justices want to reach outcomes they approve of on partisan or policy grounds, I don't think they'd be willing to disrupt too much of the existing legal framework to get there. And in this case, you really would have to abandon or apply in a very, very different way, a very broad chunk of Wisconsin equal protection law in order to strike down Act 10. And I just don't see these justices being willing to do that, no matter how much they might personally think Act 10 was a bad idea.
Now, this isn't at the state Supreme Court yet. This was in a Dane County Circuit Court to start things off. I mean, do you see it as likely it's going to end up at the state Supreme Court? I guess I've been assuming it will, because everything does. Is that necessarily the case, though?
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes these things are unclear. This one's really obvious. No matter who wins or loses at the district court, the other side will appeal. And whoever wins or loses there, the other side will appeal again. So I'm absolutely certain this will come to Wisconsin State Supreme Court. It will take time, however. It's likely to be months or a year or so before the state Supreme Court hears this case. And of course, there could be further developments before then. But yes, this question is a core question of Wisconsin constitutional doctrine. It's a pure legal question, so nothing that's decided at the district court level can really prevent, you know, the issue being raised at a higher court. So, yeah, absolutely, I think this is going to be at the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Let's bring on a caller. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hey.
Hello, gentlemen. So my question is would it be constitutional to treat different employees differently because of their political persuasion? So if the teachers union and the county workers who got the shaft are vote Democrat, but the cops and the firefighters who supported Scotty Walker and his crew, is it legal, do you think, constitutional for you to say, you know what, you guys support me, so I'm going to leave you alone. You guys don't, so I'm going to give you the shaft.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. That political argument has been made, Howard, that this was punishing a perceived political rival and not punishing sympathetic public union employees. Will that matter? Could it matter in a court argument?
Oh, it absolutely could. That is, so first of all, yes, that would be unconstitutional and illegal. No question about it. And that was the argument that was brought before. It was a First Amendment challenge saying that certain classes of employees were being punished for their expressions of political viewpoints through their unions. The problem is that when we're dealing with an equal protection challenge at this low rational basis level of review, you would have to prove that that was actually the intention. It's obviously the case that it's sort of interesting coincidence that the unions who are most notably anti-Scott Walker ended up losing their collective bargaining abilities, and it's not at all surprising that many people jumped to the conclusion, which may even be true, that it was political retaliation or an attempt to strengthen the Republican hold on the legislature. But from a legal perspective, one would have to demonstrate that. The government can come back and say, no, we had this alternative reason you haven't considered, which is by itself rational and legitimate, and as long as that's true, as long as that alternative basis exists, unless you can affirmatively prove that it was a pretext, that it really was specifically, subjectively intended as political punishment, the fact that there's an alternative, legitimate explanation defeats the legal argument. And that's the situation that we're in here now. If Scott Walker had given a speech saying, boy, I'm sure going to stick it to Democratic-leaning unions, and that's why I'm promoting this law, we would be in a very different conversation. If you want a comparison, the lawsuit that's being brought against Governor DeSantis by Disney is an example where arguably a governor really did come out and say, I'm doing this to punish a political opponent. And sure enough, in that lawsuit, the First Amendment claim seems very strong. Here, we don't really have that.
Jimmy, thanks for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison political science professor emeritus Howard Schwaber about the newest lawsuit challenging Act 10 in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the equal protection arguments we've been hearing about in this lawsuit? Do you think this is a valid argument to overturn Act 10? What do you think the courts will do, should do? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Howard Schwaber, political science professor emeritus, affiliate law school faculty at UW-Madison, with us today to look at the legal arguments in the latest lawsuit looking to overturn Act 10 in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Act 10 has been a positive for Wisconsin or a negative? Either way, what do you think of this legal challenge, this new legal challenge to it? Do you want to see it succeed or not? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Howard, another issue here. The newest justice, Janet Protasiewicz, seen as being on the liberal side of things, had told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel earlier this year that she would consider recusing herself from cases involving Act 10. Here's a listen.
You know, I'd have to think about it. I was interviewed by the New York Times, and they said, what do you think? Do you think that Act 10 was unconstitutional? And I said, yeah, I agree with the dissent in that case. You know, the dissent, I think Ann Walsh Bradley authored the dissent in that case. And I said, I do agree with the dissent in that case. Given the fact that I marched, given the fact that I signed the recall petition, would I recuse myself? Maybe, but I don't know for sure.
Okay, Howard, what should sway that maybe one way or the other in considering recusal?
Right, so it's worth pointing out that Brian Hagedorn was involved in giving legal advice to the legislature when this law was being drafted. So if there's a recusal argument here, it could apply to more than one justice. Really, this comes down to sort of the law versus, or the ethics versus the politics of it. On the law and ethics side, there's no need that I can see for Protasiewicz to recuse herself. She has expressed a legal opinion about a legal issue, and in that sense, you know, maybe said to have prejudged the question before, but it was on a lawsuit that was on a different legal theory. She has not expressed anything, as far as I know, on the specific equal protection argument that's being brought right now. And more generally, recusal is most appropriate where a judge or a justice has a personal interest in one of the parties, a financial interest, for example, or a personal relationship. You know, and in the past, we had a situation of conservative justices in Wisconsin not recusing themselves in cases involving questioning the legality of contributions to their own campaigns. So, you know, this whole recusal thing is a bit of a partisan hypocrisy on the legal side. Politically, however, Protasiewicz might want to think about recusing, particularly if she is able to canvass her fellow justices and determines that her vote wouldn't make any difference on the outcome. I'm obviously speculating wildly now, but looking down the road, by the time this thing does reach the state Supreme Court, if Justice Protasiewicz determines that there's enough of a majority one way or the other, that this case, that her vote won't change the case, it may be politically a wise thing to do just to demonstrate her impartiality. I fear that I've actually, in the interest of being simplifying, left out what might be the most important argument. So let me mention it very quickly. One argument that's being made is that even if there's a good basis for treating public safety employees different from general employees, the way this law works is dishonest because some public safety employees are treated differently than other public safety employees. So for example, Wisconsin State Police are exempt from Act 10, but Capitol Police and University of Wisconsin Police are not. Now, I would think there could be a rational basis of the sort that I described earlier for saying that a disruption in the operations of the state police is more dangerous to the state than a disruption in the operations of the Capitol Police or the University Police. But that might be, of all the elements of the complaint as I read it, that struck me as the strongest one because that becomes the argument, see, this really is a pretext. You don't really care about singling out public safety groups. You're really going after unions who don't support you. And if you want to show that kind of pretext, one way to do that is to show inconsistency in the application of the definition. So if there's a basis on which the Supreme Court might strike down Act 10, I think that would likely be it.
On the recusal issue, Chris and Dolivan called in a little while ago, couldn't stay on the line. Talking about pressure on Protasiewicz to recuse from any Act 10 case based on her previous comments. Chris says, so what? We elected her knowing what she said. Why should she recuse? He says, I don't get it. So does, I guess, a judge being judged by the voters erase comments that we might say would be prejudicial in a case she might hear in the future?
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, so if you have a lawsuit between, you know, Mr. Smith and Mrs. Jones, and the judge as a candidate said, boy, that Mrs. Jones is a terrible person, I would certainly rule in favor of Mr. Smith, that's a problem. That's indicating preference for a party. But of course we ask judges and judicial candidates their opinions on legal questions and constitutional issues, and we want them to tell them what they think. The alternative has become, right, the kind of charade we see in nominations to the Supreme Court, where justices insist, oh, they've never considered, you know, whether there's a right to abortion or other constitutional questions. There are a couple of justices who arguably committed perjury who are sitting on the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court right now, on questions of that type. So, of course, it ought not to be disqualifying simply to have said, I feel X about a legal issue or a constitutional principle. This case comes a little closer in the sense that Act 10 applies to certain parties, these unions, and is a highly partisan issue. And Prozevich didn't just express an opinion. She also participated in protests and signed recall petitions. So, you know, perhaps there's more here, but I think the caller, Chris, is exactly right, that this idea that you can push for recusal of a justice anytime they have a known philosophical position on a legal issue is just wrongheaded. And frankly, it's a created standard that's been manufactured this year.
In just our last half a minute or so, Howard, what, especially if there's something we haven't talked about, what are you watching for as this thing makes its way through the courts? Again, just in our last half minute.
Sure. So there are five or six different ways of framing the issue in the complaint. Which ones of them survive? And what is the more specific focus that this case will have by the time it gets to the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at the UW-Madison. He was with us today for a look at the latest lawsuit over Act 10 in Wisconsin, how it compares to previous attempts to overturn the law. If you have more questions about how this works, the procedure, we'd love to tackle them or share them with our news team. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can follow reporting on this case. There's already been a lot. You can find it at WPR.org and then follow along as the case proceeds through the state court system. Again, find all of that at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, if you are confused by modern tipping culture, when to tip, who to tip, how much to tip, you are definitely not alone. Get some advice over the etiquette of tipping in the modern age, and sometimes when the cash register asks you itself instead of expecting you to know what to do. And you can share your tipping do's and don'ts as a customer or a service provider. Join the conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. This week marks a milestone in communication history with a great development, or a terrible development, depending on how you feel about text messages. As reported at history.com, on December 3rd, 1992, the first SMS text message was sent. That stands for Short Message Service. It became the standard for cell phone texting for years until it was outpaced by messaging apps. The first text message was sent by a 22-year-old engineer doing work for the company Vodafone in the UK. So a few weeks early, it read, Merry Christmas. There's just one problem with this breakthrough in texting technology. Nobody had phones that could text yet. That had to wait for another year until the first text-worthy cell phones hit the market. The newfangled texting concept seems to have caught on over the 30 years since then. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest has spent most of her professional and retired career trying to better understand single people in a society and culture that has for generations largely normalized and promoted people partnering up as the ideal way of living. She's been on a mission to get people to reinvent how they think and talk about living single. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you single? Is it by choice? How's being single been good for you, for your life? Were you partnered before, made a choice to become and stay single? And if you're single, what do you hear from other people? Do you get pressure? to not be single soon or in the distant future? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bella DiPaolo has researched and written about single people for decades. She writes the long-running Living Single blog for Psychology Today. She's an academic affiliate in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She gave a very popular TEDx talk called What No One Ever Told You About People Who Are Single. Her newest book is called Single at Heart: The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. Bella, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I love talking about this.
I can tell. Now, you reference your origin story, a specific day, December 17th, 1992, that you decided, hey, I'm going to switch what I work on and start studying single people. Why does that day turn into such a pivot point for you?
Yes, it was around the holidays, and there was an advice column in my local newspaper, and it was from someone who was widowed and sad to be alone during the holidays, and the advice columnist wrote a whole answer, and I underlined one sentence: remember that one is a whole number. Now, I didn't feel like I wasn't whole because I was single, but I thought it was really interesting that people would have that assumption that, oh, you need to be reassured that you're a whole person because you're single. Where did that come from? So I started keeping notes and files of all these different kinds of evidence of how people treat single or single people or think about them. Remember the Kathy cartoons from a long time ago? She was always saying, "Heck, you know, that's single." But even prestigious publications like the New Yorker and the New York Times were publishing comments about single people that were just disparaging. So at an event, at a social event one time, I went up to someone who I knew was single, but I didn't know her very well. And I said, "Have you ever had the experience of people like treating you differently because you're single?" Like for me, for example, the person organizing the class schedule said she wanted me to come in at night because it would be too hard for the married faculty. And this was before any of them even had kids. Well, this other person said, "Oh, yes." And she started telling me her stories. Then other people joined the group and they started telling their stories. And we talked all night. And then I opened my email the next day and I had emails from some of them and they said, "Oh, and another thing." So it was clear. This is something that resonates. And I'm an academic, I'm a professor, but a retired professor. But, you know, I realized this is something I want to get out there beyond just the halls of academia. This is something that people without higher degrees care about a lot.
Now, you formed this concept, that's also the title of your book, coincidentally, of somebody being single at heart, based not just on your experience, but on survey data and interview data with people around the world in many cases. What do we mean by single at heart?
Yes, people who are single at heart love being single. They want to be single. They're choosing it. They want to stay single. They are happy and flourishing because they are single, not in spite of it. Single life is a better life for them. It's their most meaningful, fulfilling, satisfying, and joyful life.
And you hear again and again the negatives, the yeah buts. And I think one of the top ones is going to be, yeah, but if you're not lonely now, you're going to be someday. This is something that, and this is not just you have heard this. A lot of the people you talk to have heard this. What is the response to that?
Oh, this is some of my favorite data. Sure, that's the stereotype. You poor thing. You think you're happy now. Just wait till you grow older. Well, there are now several studies, big national studies, following people, single people over the course of their lives. And they find, first of all, at every age from 20 to 96, they are on the happy side of the scale. And as they approach midlife and onto later life, they just keep getting happier and happier with their lives. And the people who want to be single, who are not looking for a partner, are becoming even happier. And one of the reasons the single at heart people are doing so well in later life is that they cherish solitude. They savor it. They're not afraid of being alone. And because they appreciate the time they have to themselves and they're comfortable with them, with it, that protects them from being lonely. It got us all through the worst of the pandemic. And it means that as we grow older, and I'm 70, by the way, as we grow older, we are very unlikely to become that stereotypical older person who feels isolated and lonely. That's not who we are. And one of the reasons we're not is because we have been tending to our friends and the people we care about all along. You know, there's this thing that some coupled people do, not all of them, but research shows that on average, when people who are coupled move in together or they get married, they become more insular. They kind of, their life becomes all about each other. And they do this even if they don't have kids. And so they're demoting their friends from dinner to lunch or, you know, weekend plays to plays for their that their kids give at their schools. Whereas single people and people who are single at heart and want to stay single, they don't do that. They're tending to the people in their lives who matter to them. And so those people are still there for them later in their life. Whereas the people who got married and then put their friends on the back burner, and again, not all married people do that. When they get divorced or widowed, wow, they are, then they're stuck. It's like they believe those song lyrics, "You are my everything. I just want to be your everything." But if that's true, then when you're divorced or widowed, you've got nothing.
Talking to Bella DiPaolo about her new book, Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Sandy is with us in Mineral Point. Sandy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I am one of those single at heart people because I enjoy being single. I enjoy the freedom. I enjoy my friends. And despite the societal norms that have pushed on me always to get married and have kids, is like now I'm just not that interested.
Sandy, thanks a lot for the call. Now, Bella, Sandy mentioned two key F words there. Friends, you were just talking about that,
yeah.
And freedom. And then when you've talked to people and surveyed people about the values that make them happy to be single, that word, freedom, seems to come up an awful lot.
It did. When I asked people who are single at heart to tell me their life stories and I asked them, what do you like about being single? Every one of them said freedom.
What is it about that value of freedom that is such a motivator for people who are single at heart?
I think what happens is that people who are single at heart use their freedom to pursue their interests and their values and to build a life that reflects who they are authentically. There are big studies based on hundreds and thousands of people from, I think, about 31 European nations that look at how much people value freedom and creativity and trying new things. And people who value freedom are happier, whether they're married or single. But the single people value it more and they get more out of it. So freedom makes single people even happier than it makes married people.
Thanks again for that call, Sandy. We're talking to Bella DiPaolo, an expert on single life who writes the Living Single blog at Psychology Today. We're talking about her new book. It's called Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Are you single at heart yourself? Does that concept make sense to you? Does it make sense to other people in your life, or do you gotta get a lot of pushback? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with single life expert Bella DiPaolo, author of several books and the Living Single blog for Psychology Today. Her newest book is called Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Themes about how we think about single people come up a lot in pop culture. Here's a listen to the TV show 30 Rock, Alec Baldwin's character Jack Donaghy questioning Tina Fey's Liz Lemon.
Do you agree that you need someone in your life, Lemon?
No, I have bigger things to worry about than my personal life.
I would think that a single woman's biggest worry would be choking to death alone in her apartment. I have a friend in town I'd like to set you up with.
No, thank you.
Thomas is very bright, has a wonderful sense of humor. I think it's a good match. Are you free on Thursday?
No, Thursday is poker night. And by the way, it is completely inappropriate for you to be questioning me about my private life and then trying to set me up with someone when you don't even know anything about me.
Poker night, who plays?
Really? That's all you got out of that?
All right, Bella, first of all, the helpful friend, or in this case, coworker or boss, who's going to set you up with somebody because you need somebody. A common situation for the single at heart?
Yes, that was such a great clip. Thank you. And the assumptions behind that are just appalling, you know, that she needs someone that she needs to be fixed up as if she's broken, as if she doesn't have a life that's full and fulfilling and joyful and a life that she chose. And those kinds of assumptions come up all the time. And for people who are not just single, but single at heart and love their single lives and want to stay single, in a way, it's even worse because people just, they can't fathom that. And so they'll say to us, oh, you just think that now, you'll get over it, or you just haven't met the right person. It's like they can't accept our own reports of how we feel, what we think about our lives. They think they know what's good for us better than we do. It's amazing. I mean, no one would ever say to a married person, oh, you know, you just think you like being married. Wait a few years, you'll get over it. You just don't know how to do single life.
And actually, the thing that pointed me toward that clip was the bit about, you know, you should be worried about choking to death alone in your apartment. There's a section in your book where this is a common objection. Like, hey, when you're older, you're going to need that significant other to help watch for your health.
Right. And what I say in the book is you're better off with a medical alert device, because if you have a spouse, you know, they might be at work or doing errands or traveling. And if you have a medical alert device, you know, it's always there. So get that. And you know that famous ad, oh, I've fallen, I can't get up. You know who that was? That was a Mrs. Where was her husband?
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Juneau. Jim, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
What do you want to tell us about?
About four years back, I broke up with a girlfriend, and, you know, it hurt at first, and I was kind of lost a little bit. But a little bit into that, I asked myself the question of exactly what I had lost. And to be honest, ever since then, I realized that I am a lot more stress-free without a relationship than I ever was able to be when I had a relationship. And I'm actually being a big part of my grandkids' lives now, which is much more important to me than, you know, trying to start up a new relationship.
So you're going to stick with it? Is that the plan, Jim? You're single at heart now?
Don't get me wrong. I date and stuff, but, you know, I at the end of the day, you know, if I'm not looking for something to you know, fix my life, I'm happy with my life finally.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Bella, that matches up with, I think, many of the stories you share in the new book.
It does. And what's wonderful about this story is that he is showing that he values relationships, but not just in the narrow, stingy sense of the word when we use relationships to mean just romantic relationships. He cares about his grandkids and he understands their value. And that's one of the real strengths of people who are single at heart. A lot of people think, oh, if you're single, your life is more limited. But if you're single at heart, it's just the opposite, because we don't buy into the idea that there's only one kind of relationship that counts, or that love only comes in the romantic variety, or that family only is the people that are traditionally defined as family. We might have close friends that we consider family. We understand that intimacy could include sexual intimacy, but it also includes emotional intimacy. And all of those examples are reasons why single life can be so fulfilling.
Jim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234, talking to Bella DiPaolo about her new book, Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. Back to your calls. Fred is with us in Adams County. Fred, hi.
Good afternoon, Public Radio. Look, I've been I'm in my early 80s. I've been single for 30 years. I'll tell you, it's tough out there for women. I'll tell you what, most women, I'm working class kind of guy. They're lonesome. They're looking for a man. They're looking for somebody to fix their car. And I mean, when I got divorced for a big, large corporation in 1991, the women came out of the woodwork. I could have been married many times. I like women and everything, but this lady talks like she's in love with herself, and that's wonderful. But I'll tell you, women, they're competing for men out there, even at my age. Talk about...
Gotcha. Fred, thanks a lot for the call. Now, Bella, you are very clear in the book. Single life is happy for people who are, as you define it, single at heart. All those lessons don't apply if somebody's single but genuinely wants to be in a partnership of some sort.
Sure. The biggest lesson of my book isn't just that we should respect and value and validate people who are single and want to be single, but that everyone should get to live the life that is best for them. So many people are what you might call coupled at heart. They're powerfully drawn to single life, and they should be valued and validated too. But the thing is, they already are. You know, they don't need any extra pats on the head or rewards or valuing. They already got that.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to talk a little bit about pop culture, Bella, because if we started listing movies where our hero starts off single at the beginning and ends up happily married or, you know, on the way at the end, we could talk all day. I try to think of movies where somebody starts off single and they end up being single and realizing they're really happy being single. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. My list is zero. They're probably out there. That message is so powerful in our popular culture.
You're right. It's so rare. And everybody is missing out when that happens. First of all the people who love being single are missing out on seeing themselves represented in popular culture. And it's sad for people watching it who aren't single at heart, who aren't going to understand that for some people, single life is their best life. And these script writers are missing out on great opportunities. I mean, imagine if they came up with a show in which they show what single at heart people are thinking that they typically only say to themselves. That's hilarious. Like, imagine what they're thinking when a group of people are together and one of them says, oh, I just got engaged, and shows the engagement ring and everybody squeals with joy. The single at heart people are really going to have a field day with that. Or, I mean, if you remember back Sex and the City, there's this famous scene where the four women are at a wedding and the bouquet gets tossed and they all look at it and watch it and let it drop in front of them. And then they turn around and walk away and go to brunch together. I mean, I just love that.
Just in our last minute or so, Bella, when somebody confronts that question in a judgy way, why are you still single? Now, the advice is don't ask that question. But for the person who's asked that question, a thought for a response that doesn't involve fisticuffs.
right? You know, I like to be straightforward and say I love being single and I don't ever want to be anything else. But you can also ask what Chris Marsh suggests this in her great book. She asks, why do you ask that? And if you keep asking that, they will realize what an inappropriate question it is.
Bella, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Bella DiPaolo, expert on single life, who writes the Living Single blog for Psychology Today. She's an academic affiliate in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, breaking up is hard to do even when you're breaking up with a friend. We'll talk about the best ways to end friendships when they've run their course and take a wider look at the state of friends and friendship here in the United States. And body mass index, or BMI, is a commonly used shorthand for measuring our healthy weight, and it's a commonly criticized measurement as well. We'll check out the uses and misuses of BMI at the doctor's office and what it means in the era of a new breed of weight loss medications as well. Share your thoughts on that right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Join the conversation tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's been a year since the release of ChatGPT, a large language learning program that's shaking up schools and workplaces in the creative world. Find out what's changed and what the future could hold. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.